Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to the 305th episode of the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. I'm Kyle Barton of K. Barton Tools, and I'm here with Sean Wisniewski of the Corner Workshop. Today, we're visiting with custom furniture maker, instructor, and author Daryl Peart. Welcome to the show, Daryl.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Good.
Awesome to have you, for sure.
And for listeners, this is our second time recording this show. Figured we'd let everyone know. We had some problems. I've seen and heard of this happening to other podcasts. It's never happened to ours until yesterday. So we're re-recording this episode with Daryl, and unfortunately, we almost got all the way through our first episode. So anyway, so bear with us if some of this sounds like we've known each other for a long time, because now we have. And I did get the pronunciation of your last name right this time.
That's right. And that's unusual. It's usually, I tell people it's Peart, and they pronounce it back as Pert. It's Peart.
Peart.
Yes.
Yep. Okay, so let's turn into what's up in the woodworking news. So I have a few things. So first off, a sad announcement that Phil Lowe's school has closed, the Furniture Institute of Massachusetts. So I know a number of fantastic woodworkers went through there that are known, and probably many, many more that are not as well known but are fantastic woodworkers. And it's kind of a sad day.
It is sad, and you're thinking it's kind of COVID related, kind of retirement, kind of one than the other.
I'm not really sure exactly. I know I saw some posts about it, and some folks seemed to know something, but they didn't say what the exact reason is. But I also want to mention about the Austin School of Furniture and Design. They have the Texas Woodworking Festival. Well, it was scheduled in April of 2020, and of course COVID came and they had to cancel it. And they were going to push it back till September, I believe it was. But they just decided here recently, hey, we're just going to cancel it for this year. And so they do have a date for next year. That's April 17th, 2021, which hopefully will be a much better year. But moving on, I also want to highlight, I don't know if this is new to me. I think it is. I think it's been out for a while, but I just came across it. And it's called the Easy Tension. It's a bandsaw tensioning jig. Easy for me to say. But you know, tensioning your bandsaw blade correctly can be, you know, kind of problematic in some respects. I just do the finger test where I put my finger against it, and it feels fairly firm, but not too firm, and I go from there. And I've actually had good results doing that. But if you really want to get your bandsaw tensioned correctly and accurately, you need some sort of jig like this. It's not very expensive. I think it's like $40.
Yeah.
Which is really neat, and I think I'm gonna pick one of these up.
Yeah, I'm kind of eager to see how you find it. It's a pretty unique little tool. It does look pretty modern. Actually, looking about their little about section, looks like the idea started in 2014, and he mentions 5 years and nights of weekends and 40 prototypes later. You know, now we have this. So this may only be a year old or so. At the time. A unique way of doing it. I mean, it's for those that aren't looking at what we're looking at, you know, it's a bit of plastic with magnets in it, and you kind of stick them to your blade. And there's a post that goes in a certain depth depending on the thickness of your blade, or the width of your blade, I should say.
Yeah.
And it basically, by a preset depth, when you do install this thing, at some point of tension, the magnets will be separated because the post will then be at a certain tension. And just pops off. And that's it's such a simple thing. Because I've done the hand screw up on top and plucking it, going doop, 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 doop. Yep. It's like a weird guitar, you know. And and that, you know, I can't deflect it super big. If I really lean my thumb into it, it's probably good. Mm-hmm. You know, and it is. It's guesswork. And I know who's the Carter guy that makes the little deer.
I know who you're talking about.
I can't think of his name, but isn't he the guy that is like, you don't need to worry about tension. You just got to know the saw. you know, so you learn a drift and you learn all this other things.
Right.
And, I mean, there's different schools of thought. I get it. But this seems like a really, and like you said, inexpensive little tool to try to figure out. So, yeah, I'm kind of eager to hear how you find it.
Yeah,
I don't have a bandsaw of my own. I have to envy yours.
Well, next up, I wanted to mention a couple of books that Lost Art Press has released. And the first one, it's Kitchen Think by Nancy Hiller. That's her book on basically remodeling, redesigning, whatever you need to do with kitchens. It's in this book. So if you've ever decided, hey, I'm going to rip out my kitchen and put my own custom-made cabinets, I would highly recommend you get this book.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're building just regular casework that might go somewhere in your house and have to be a functional piece of a shelving or drawers or something, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of great ideas in this book.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if I remember correctly, she is a classically trained English casework something or other. Whatever her credentials
exactly.
are.
Exactly.
But I mean, she knows her way around, and that's a really cool thing because it has broader applications than just in your kitchen, obviously.
And I think that's most of her business is doing built-ins and kitchens and things of that nature. But the book's only $38, and if you get it, I think they're due to ship out sometime in August. But if you order it before August, you get the PDF free. So, and then they'll ship the book and you get the PDF right away. So, I highly recommend that. If you wait till, the book starts shipping, then you can still get the PDF. It's just, you're going to get charged for it. So it's kind of an incentive to buy early. Also, Lost Art Press, Christopher Swartz published his latest book in the Anarchist series. I think it's his last book on the workbench. At least that's what he's telling everyone. But it's called The Anarchist Workbench. And he's using his, 20 plus year journey in building benches to say, okay, this is the last bench. This is the one that incorporates all the ideas he's come from, the Roman benches all the way up to, the modern benches. And this is supposed to be the end all and be all of benches. What's interesting about the book is it's free. Yes, it's free. You can download a PDF. You can do anything you want with that PDF except sell it. You can take it to a printer and have them print it into a book or whatnot. But if you want a nice bound book, that's one of the things Lost Art Press is known for is the quality of their books. You can actually purchase this book too for $27. Well, let's get into what's in the shop. So, Sean, what's in your shop?
Well, Kyle, it's summertime.
It is.
So that means my shop time is largely outside because I got a big old yard. I'm currently itching my knee because I got stung by one of our bees. And I've got poison ivy on my arms and mosquitoes are out. So it's good times to be working outside. But also, so the reason I'm getting mosquito bitten and that I'm not always working with my bees, but I'm working on my shed very slowly. But currently, my shed out there has floor joists on foundation stones. So it's in place and it's leveled-ish. I'll correct that as we go a little bit, but it's pretty darn level. And now I've got to finalize my design, get lumber delivered, get stone delivered to put underneath it because I'm just trying to keep the weeds down.
Right.
What's in your shop?
What's in my shop? Well, I modified my Windsor stretcher jig a little bit. It's what I'm calling my Mark II version. Has all the same functionality as the one I have been selling. But what I've done is I've actually made the tenon on it a little bit wider or thicker and a little bit longer because I'm no longer restricted to my tapered tenon cutter. So before, I was using my tapered tenon cutter to make those 6-degree tapered tenons on it. But since I've moved to the pattern routing technique that I've talked about, I can now routed tenon as small or as large and as long as I want to. So I basically increased the diameter to it's now a full inch diameter, and it's a little under 3/4 inch at the small end. And so I made that little change, and then I did another change to the top part where the threaded rod screws into it. I actually put a recessed a washer in there for the jam nut to lock up again. This is kind of like a design I had when I first made this, is to put that washer, but I was kind of worried about when the jam nut locks on the washer, if it would throw the threaded rod out of alignment in any way. And after a lot of testing, I decided, nope, it doesn't. So I decided it's just kind of a creature comfort. So I put it in there. And, you know, for folks that bought my other jig, you can do the same thing. Of course, the washer won't be recessed, but you can take a washer and put over there and just put two little tiny drops of CA glue, and that will hold it on there so it doesn't come off every time you take the threaded rod off. Yeah, it works really well, and so I'm excited about that. Rockler came out with a portable drill guide, they're calling it, and you've probably seen these before. It's these guides that have two rods and has a drill chuck mounted into it, and the drill chuck goes up and down on the two rods to drill straight holes. You're basically taking a mini drill press to your work, and you can do angled holes with it. And you know, I had one of those back in the day, and they were crap. Absolute crap. And anyone that's had one or used one knows what I'm talking about. Well, Rockler decided to come out with their own, and it's really well engineered. And, you know, when I developed my boring jig, I was actually looking for something like this that was on the market, and there wasn't anything. And I eventually came out with my boring jig. So I decided, well, let me look at this thing and see how it works. So I ordered one, and it's really well done. It's got a half inch chuck instead of the 3/8 inch chuck. So it'll take all my chair making bits. And I said, well, you know, let me see, drill some holes. I actually glued up a seat blank and marked it up and started to drill holes with it. It will work, but it's really finicky to set up for angled holes. And it's a little large. I even put a sub base under it, similar to what I used with my jigs, two long pieces of wood, so you can clamp at various angles. But even so, this thing is pretty bulky. And, you know, for what I'm using it for, to drill out Windsor seats, it's really not ideal. You could probably do it, but, you know, when you're getting into some of those tight outer spindles or doing an arm post, it may be a little hard to get this thing, you know, securely clamped and done. But, you know, it would work. Like I said, I must say it's well built. So if you're looking for something like that outside of chair making, I would recommend it. You know, I wonder if this had been in the market when I came up with my boring jig, if I would have, or I would have just come up with some fixtures to attach to this one to make it, you know, more perform a little bit better. Like I said, you know, and it's $150. It's basically the same cost as my boring jig. So
it does it differently.
But it does it differently. Mine's a little bit nimbler, quicker to set up, and a lot easier to clamp, especially, like I said, doing Windsors and stuff. But
now they show a product photo of them doing a chair seat. I won't claim that it's Windsor necessarily, but
yeah.
Are you suggesting that it may not be an easy operation to do that, you know, with that?
It's not as easy as my jig. I can tell you that.
Right.
It can be done. So,
right.
So let's say you were looking for some of this and you were interested in Windsors, but you were only building, you know, one chair or two, you could probably get away with it. But I'm not saying that setting this up and drilling out a seat blank is going to be any faster than using, you know, the tried and true old techniques of the mirrors and bevel squares and squares and stuff like that. It's probably going to be about the same speed, just due to you're going to have to find a clamping solution. You're going to have to get it to the right angle. I mean, they do have angle marks on it, but it's like every 5 degrees.
Right.
So you basically have to, the way I did it was attach a, one of those electronic bevel gauges, that, you know, are magnetic, and attach that to the chuck to be able to, you know, get the angle right. But I did find, you know, once I got the angle
right and locked down. It locked down securely. It didn't move, but it still was, you know, it's going to take you, you know, probably 5 to 10 minutes a hole, where my jig takes you about a minute or two tops.
There you go. There you go.
But yeah, that's what I've been up to. So, Daryl, tell us what's going on in your shop.
Okay. Well, right now I've just finished up kind of getting ready for Mark Spagnuolo to come, and we're going to film the Fremont Chest of Drawers. Mm-hmm. We were originally going to do that in March, but that's when everything locked down, so it got canceled. And so next week, Mark will be here. He'll be here Monday, and we're going to start filming. And there's a lot of prep work to go on that. So that's what I've been mostly working on. But mm-hmm. since I've basically done, and I just kind of go back and do a little pickup work, I've also been rearranging the furniture in the shop, building new cabinets, putting up my old vintage stereo gear in the shop, and kind of make it cozy, trying to get the shop ready for my semi-retirement and focus more on a fun shop rather so much on a production shop.
Yes.
Is any of your focus to be photogenic there while Mark is filming, just as a background to not be?
Yeah, well, that was part of the impetus too, you know, is I had this real ugly spot where behind my bench. And whenever I do an Instagram account, I've had to go, oh, I take a shot, and then I go look over there where I look at the photo and go, what? Oh, no, that was in the background, you know? And so and it's real distracting when you're trying to focus on something else and there's this, I don't know, overflowing garbage can or something in the background.
Sure.
So anyway, it's a lot more, it's friendlier on the eyes too for photography.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, you have a real love for vintage audio.
Yeah, that's been going on since I was 20 years old. I lusted after Marantz and AR and Sansui back when I was in my early 20s, and I could mm-hmm. hardly afford any of that stuff. And now I've got it all over the place. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 sets of vintage. That's 4 receivers and 4 sets of speakers just in the shop here.
Wow.
Then there's more in the house.
Jeez. Quite the collection.
And the sad thing is you know, after 50 years of woodworking and loud machinery, my hearing isn't what it was when I was 20 years old either. But it's just fun to look at all the neat lights on the blue lights on the Marantz mm-hmm. and stuff.
Right.
And it's a feel good thing.
Hey, yeah, turn it little up, man. Let it. I mean.
Yeah, and that wheel that they have on the Marantz.
The tuning wheel for the that's neat. And those blue lights, I love those blue lights.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I got my start years ago with a Onkyo integrated amp. I don't even think Onkyo is a going concern anymore.
Oh yeah, I'm stuck in the 70s, so I've heard the name, but
they were more 80s, but yeah. Yeah, but anyway, well, let's get into a little bit of the interview here. So for listeners, I'm sure everyone knows who you are, your passion for green and green and somewhat. But tell us a little bit about your background, how you got started in this career of yours and what brought you to green and green.
Yeah, most of my background is kind of commercial, industrial. You know, I've worked in a lot of big shops. Early on, when I was about 20 years old, I got a job working in a shop making laminated beams, which introduced me. It was really, really crude woodworking, but it introduced mm-hmm. me to, the feel of a router in my hand and using some saws and drills and all that stuff. And at one point I quit that job and felt kind of lost and went on it's a long story. I went on a hitchhike to San Francisco, and got a ride back with this woman who, sold stuff at the Pike Place Market. And I thought, I would love to sell stuff and do kind of a, craftsy type thing. And I thought, well, what do I know how to do? Well, I know how to hold a router and do some saws and stuff. So, that's kind of where it started. But then I did that for a couple years and realized I was not learning anything new. So I went from there on, I got jobs at places that made, I'd worked at kitchen cabinets for a while. And then mostly I worked at Millwright places. We did a lot of conference tables, custom office furniture, stuff like that. And I bounced around several years at different places. I would work a couple years in some place. Well, by this time I had kids and family and responsibility, so I couldn't go to a school or anything like that. So the way I learned things was, I'd think, well, you know, I found out that over at this other shop over here, they're doing this really neat thing and I want to learn how to do that. So I'd go pester those people till I got a job. And I would just kind of bounce around at different places to fill in my education. Mm-hmm. But most of what I know is kind of from the industrial world. So I always wanted to do kind of the hand tool thing, but I never quite got there because I always knew how to do it a different way.
Right.
And then the green and green thing, was that?
I get exposed to green and green and then fall in love.
Yeah, it was a coworker who I worked with years ago, and he was a green and green fanatic. And at that time, I really didn't like green and green. I was turned off by them. I thought they were just horrible at one point, believe it or not. But as I was working on this big job with this guy, he kept doing a running commentary on green and green, and he brought in his only, I think it was the only book out on green and green, Randall Mackinson's book, Furniture and Related Designs. And pretty soon I started taking a closer look and I liked what I saw. And the closer I looked, the more I saw on these details. There was just this whole universe of design and how everything, you know, it's not just the design had life to it. All these little elements of the design all related to the other parts of the design. And it was, there was details within details. And there was, anyway, I dived in and was a fanatic for, I couldn't get enough of them for 20 years. I've kind of come on the other side of that now. I still love green and green to no end, but I'm no longer, going down to Pasadena and hiking myself up on the top of a fence to get a photo shot of a house back in there, you know?
Right. Yeah. Cause that is interesting that, the Green and Greens kind of did a little development project right around, the Gamble house. It's like, there's like a couple of streets around. There's a bunch of Green and Green houses.
Yeah. Well, all over Pasadena and LA and stuff. One time we were down there, my wife and I, this is when we first got those, GPS's in the cars, and you could put in an address and it optimize all these addresses. Well, we put in every green and green address we could find, and we spent a couple of days just driving from one to the next.
Wow.
And
so how close is the nearest green and green house to you? Is there any in Northern California, or is it all
Carmel is closest one that still exists. There used to be one in Vancouver, BC.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes. Well, very few people do. It was not built by the Greens. It was designed by the Greens.
But
I drove up there a few years ago too, and ran down the address. It's a parking lot now. The house has been torn down years ago.
Oh, that's sad.
That's awful.
It is. And there's another house that people like to, in Portland, Oregon, they like to claim a green and green connection to, but it's kind of distant. There was a guy that worked in the Greens architectural office, and he designed it. And the story goes that Charles Green was on a trip to Seattle back in the day and stopped in at this house and gave it his okie dokie. So it's a stretch,
but
yeah.
Now, isn't there's a fraternity house that's green and green, isn't there?
That's a Thorson house. I spent the night in the Thorson house at one point. It's it's kind of a sad case, but the students do as best they can to keep it, you know, in shape. But it's kind of run down. Mm-hmm. But it that's in Berkeley.
I'd seen something about that, and I thought it was kind of interesting. Hopefully they're not holding keggers in the place, but I'm sure they did in the past.
Well, they are, but they assure us that they're cognizant of what they're in, and they keep people from, I guess, I don't know, doing too many outrageous things that would destroy the house.
That's great. So once you got into the Green and Green, when did you actually start becoming your own, you know, custom furniture maker and start really, you know, diving into your own designs using the influences from Green and Green? Now, you have some Krenov influence too.
Yes. Early on, I was much more into Krenov, and I still am a Krenov fanatic. But I guess I never really did look to Green and Green to do exact copies. I've only done one exact copy in my entire career. I've done what I used to call near reproductions, which meant that I kind of took an original design and changed some things that I wanted to change. But way back when, I would do my own designs, you know, just using the Green and Green motifs, mm-hmm. you know. I started doing that kind of stuff. That reproduction piece was 1998, 97, something like that. My first Green and Green little motifs kind of crept into my work in the early 90s, 92, 93, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
And then you've designed some your own kind of take on Green and Green motifs that look like they wore Green and Green, but they're not. They're yours.
yeah. Well, in fact,
because don't you have that little, I don't forgot what you call it, but like on the blanket chest, that little saddle piece that goes over one of the rails?
Oh, yeah. The strap detail.
Yes. That's it.
I used to go, I do a little web search once in a while and see if some woodworking forum was talking about me or something. And I just kind of peek in to see what they're saying. And my name was mentioned this one time and they were talking about who's your favorite designer, you know, and someone mentioned me and another guy said, oh, he's just doing original Green and Green reproductions. And you know, that was both good and bad. It's good mm-hmm. that they thought that I was good enough to compare my stuff to the originals, but it's bad that I wasn't getting recognized for my own thing. Mm-hmm. And so I think that spurred me on to a little bit to kind of do stuff that's distinctively outside of Green and Green. But I'm so infused with Green and Green, I just can't quite let go of all the motifs. Right. You know, they're still there, but I've went off on a tangent a little further.
That's all right.
Yeah, that's fine. Now you have your Aurora nightstand and your Fremont, and those all echo from, I believe it's a Fremont Street Bridge.
No, the Aurora.
Aurora Bridge.
Aurora Bridge in Seattle. The Aurora Bridge, and the Aurora stuff. Well, this was years ago, and I was kind of stuck on a design. It was my what turned out to be my Aurora table desk, and I had it on my computer at home on the CAD program, and I was at the grocery store looking at, just kind of in a stupor, looking out the window with that design on my mind, and there was the Aurora Bridge looming in those. Out in the window, and I love the arches in there, and I thought that's kind of neat. All those arches that just kind of go through the legs, and all everything is related to that arch. All these little pieces coming off the arch mm-hmm. Are connected to it, you know. And so I thought, oh, that's what I need. I need to infuse some arches in there. So I went home and drew an arch, and boy, it just all came to life. That's that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Now you've you've done the Aurora table, but you also have, or the nightstand, but you also have a Fremont nightstand that's similar, but it's more boxed in.
And then
I think you're doing the Fremont dresser, but you, both of those you're going to be able to, it's going to be featured in the Wood Whisperer Guild, Mark's guild. So
yes,
that's going to be fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it gives me more to buy from him because I already have your nightstand project, so I'll have to get the dresser project too.
Yeah, it's great to do projects with Mark for several reasons. You know, he's so relaxed when we do this thing. You know, there's no formality or anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I've done videos with Popular Woodworking, and I like that. That was fun too. But if you made a mistake, you know, there's always mistakes are part of woodworking.
Right.
Absolutely.
You know? And that's real life, you know, but when we'd be in the middle of something and I'd mess something up and they'd say, okay, let's reset. So we'd clean up the set, put everything back and then start and act like that never happened. And when I was filming the Fremont nightstand, I stripped the head off of a screw that went into the breadboard end, and I let out a string of cursing and thinking that we were just going to stop and start and do this clean. And Mark says, oh no, let's go ahead and show them how we fix this.
Yep.
And I think I don't know if he bleeped it out or just cut out my cursing, but we just kept on filming and I fixed it, you know, and that was neat because that's the real world, you know, and it's nice I don't like these things where you pretend that everything's perfect, you know, it isn't. The real world is got mistakes in it.
Right. Yeah, I have a little green and green frame I made to hold some pictures, and it had two of the ebony plugs at each corner. And this is after I built it, probably a couple of years later, I'm looking at it and I realized that one of the tiny ebony plugs I put on the right side of my marking line instead of the left. All the other three others were in the right place.
Yeah, I was a little off. In fact, just last week, I actually had a Fremont dresser out that I'm making for my wife, and it's kind of been a long process. It's been in process over a year now because I work on it in between paying things and things I have to do. But I had it was a lesson for me because I used the CNC to cut out the legs, and I told the CNC to start the holes for the ebony pegs, and it put a set of ebony pegs about an inch too low. Mm-hmm. My options were to make a really big plug that covers, because it was right at the bottom edge of the rail, and I ended up patching it. We'll see when I get the finish on it. I'm going to have to do some magic the finish repair to make it completely disappear.
Yes, exactly. Time to get out those little artist pens.
Yeah. Actually, that's I used to have a guy who Tom Dodge. He died about 2 years ago. He had a heart attack. But he would come out, and he was an artist. Boy, he could. He was repair. He did repairs. Yeah. He could. I'd call him up, and I'd say, well, you know, I got this scratch, and it goes cross grain down here on this door. And he'd say, well, I don't know if I can fix it or not. And he said that every time. He said that every time. I don't know if I can fix it or not. And he gets out here, and 10 minutes later, I can't see it. You know, it's just gone.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
I'm not nearly that good. I have to fuss with it forever, but I can get it to kind of where it hazes up and you just kind of don't notice it as much.
Right. Exactly. So, tell us a little bit about your design process. Is it based on, you know, when you design a new piece? I assume most of the time it's based on commission work. Someone says, hey, I want a piece. I want this.
Yeah, it has. Whatnot.
But what's your process to kind of incorporate all that?
Yeah, it's never quite the same.
Okay.
I'm kind of semi-retired these days, so I'm not taking too many commissions on them. My idea is to do things that I want to do. So it's kind of, I'm going to be doing speculation pieces. But when a design would come in, sometimes it was always different. You know, sometimes I would it just popped into my head and it was there, and I felt like I was cheating. You know, it was like there was the blanket chest was one of those. So, you know, it was just there, just there. And others were painful experiences. You know, I would draw it out and I'd look at it and I go, oh, right, that's not right. But you know, when I'm stuck like that, what I would do is I would just keep drawing and eliminate things. I'd say, okay, well, let's try this. And then as I kept eliminating things, there's fewer things to do, I guess. Eventually, something would start clicking. So sometimes it was just a long, drawn out, let's try this, let's try this, let's try that. Mm-hmm. Other times it was just boom, it's there. You know, it's design is an unusual thing. You know, when it starts happening, you know, that's what I like about design is you get into this zone where the entire world just disappears and it's just you and the computer screen, and time is irrelevant. Everything is just gone, and you're just there copying down just a conduit.
Right. Yeah, that is cool. So you're doing most of this stuff in CAD then?
Yeah. I've been doing CAD for 20 years or more. Mm-hmm. And CAD is really, really neat. CAD has helped me become a better designer, I think, because in the old days with the T-square, you know, you would have a new idea, an alteration. You'd be working on a design and it's there in front of you on the paper. And you think, well, I want to change this. And the options were to erase and lose what you already have. Mm-hmm. Or you have tracing paper there and add something in, which that was always, I never really liked that. But with CAD, the neat thing about CAD is you can take a copy of what you're working on and put it over to the right and make your changes. And sometimes within a few seconds, you're comparing the two. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, a lot of times these ideas are fleeting. So if you're not able to do them in really, really, really short order, by the time you get it ready to put it down, your mind it's just evaporated. The idea is gone. Mm-hmm. And so you get to, with CAD, the neat thing is you can see the changes really, really fast. And while they're still fresh in your mind.
Yeah.
Now, I like it as a, you know, design tool for sure. And the comparison thing, I mean, it's like old school animation where they would have a cell on cell and they'd make that small change and you can flip it back and forth. If you get into layering and stuff in CAD, it's really good. You can turn things off and on.
Layering is really neat in CAD.
It's such a cool thing. You can and do it with traditional drafting. You can do that kind of thing. But it just, I mean, obviously digitally, it's so much better.
Yeah,
but I'm a big fan of relative dimensioning. And you know, that's great. And that'll get you when you're working on the thing to be exact. You can't, those are the times when you like, don't trust a 3/4 inch board to be 3/4 inches, unless you are 100% precise in your machining. But there's also the aspect of CAD where math will not lie. And so if I say this thing is this length and it inserts this much, I know exactly what it needs to be.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. The precision with CAD is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
My cut lists have improved immensely because, you know, in the old days, you draw something out full scale on the floor and you've got the thickness of a pencil line. And if you're pinching an inch and you ask someone to pinch that inch and you're measuring down here, you better hope that the guy is pinching the inch knows how to pinch an inch.
I will say I went to the I put an addition on the back of my house. This isn't exactly fine woodworking, but I CADed the whole thing down to the siding, and by the end of it I had a half sheet of plywood and 1.5 sticks of siding left to put a 10x14 addition on the back of my house with 3 windows in it and all this other stuff. And I was like, I didn't have that 25% overage. I had less than 10% overage. I didn't have to buy as much. I didn't waste as much. You know, I mean, all that stuff tightens up.
Yeah. That the only time you make a mistake in measuring something in CAD is if you snap to the wrong point or something.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
And I've done that though too. But it is precise down to a few thousandths. You can put in, the layer thing. I was going to talk about. You mentioned layering. In the old days when I worked at the custom shops, I had a big pile of colored pencils, and we'd be doing a teller line or something, you know, and it's on full scale before you even start laying anything down. And each color of that pencil was a different layer, basically. And pretty soon you're looking down at that drawing and you're saying, oh man, what is that? It's just a mess of lines. Being able to turn layers off, you know, when I do a complex piece like my Aurora pedestal desk, and I have all those, you know, people want different wire ways to connect the peds to this, or they want, you know, different things. I start at the top. And I can just travel down to the bottom of the desk by turning layers off, you know, and you can see, okay, these drawers are going to fit just like this, you know, and here's this little wire way in the back of the drawer, and it's going to clear by a quarter of an inch, you know. It's neat.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, yeah, you get into, it's a little more complicated to get into sectioning and things like that, where you can actually look at a cross section of a piece and it can offer different detail or different insights into that. You know, layering will like basically strip parts away, but if you need multiple things just to see, yeah, do I have that clearance in there? Do I have space to make that happen? Even for it's an engineering term, constructability, you know, I can make this work, but the order of operations and how you do that, you need to know how it goes together.
Yes.
And that can assist in that as well.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot of mistakes are avoided because you can check them out in CAD before you get to that point.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Now your experience with CAD and stuff has, I guess, naturally led you into getting into CNC. So tell us a little bit about how long you've been doing that and what you're using your CNC for.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, my introduction to CNC was about 1995, I think, 96, 95, something like that. And that was at a place, it was a big industrial shop. They had 200 employees there, you know, so they had, you know, big monster machinery, not even something remotely that I'd ever, even in my wildest dream, think I could afford in my shop, you know. Great big monster CNC. It had about a 10 or 12 foot throw on it, two 17 horse routers, you know.
Wow.
And this was back in the days of DOS. I think when I was put onto that machine and being trained on it, I had never heard of CNC before this. And I, well, what's this? You know, and pretty soon I realized that, you know, I couldn't do a lot of programming. I could do simple squares and shapes and stuff like that. And I could run a program if someone had already written it, but I could only write very simple ones then. But I soon found out that I could lay out arcs. And if you've ever done arcs, you know, big arcs, you know, like that, like have a 30 foot radius or something. Back in the day, when we'd do a teller line or something that had a 30 foot radius in it, and you need to swing that arc, and it'd take two or three guys all day to swing that arc, you know. And
wow.
Well, because you'd have a trammel, someone had set a sheet of ply down, and then you'd connect all these pieces of ply together till you had the router out on the very end. And then when you went to swing it, you would have one guy standing on the piece of ply and four or five guys holding that trammel up where it wouldn't drag on the ground, and one guy on the router pulling it. You know,
oh my gosh.
Wow.
That's how you you were not going to be, you know, plus or minus 0.005, you know.
No.
It was plus or minus a half inch.
Right. Yeah.
If you're lucky. But when I started running the CNC and I realized, you know, I could get down to 0.001 on any radius I want. It could be a 100-foot radius, you know, and that was like a miracle to me then, you know, because I had done it the other way, and it was so that kind of got me hooked on CNC and thinking, you know, this is really great. And I would come in on my after work and on my lunchtime and stuff like that, and run out some of my own patterns for radiuses and circles and different things. Mm-hmm. And then when I left that job, I kind of, at about that time, I got into CAD, and I wanted to get into CAD so I could take the DXF file and take it to people who had a machine and hire them out to run stuff. And it was probably, I did that probably 10 or 15 years until I got my own machine 5-6 years ago, something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's revolutionized the shop.
How big is your machine that you're using?
It's a twin spindle machine. It has two spindles. And if you count the size of the bed where both spindles will hit, it's 34 by 66.
Are they on the same Trammel carriage?
Yes.
Okay.
It was a custom made machine. And it also has over travel. So the gantry will go over in the front so I can put stuff up. I can clamp to the end and route to the top of stuff, like I could do joinery if I wanted to.
Right.
Oh, cool.
So,
Have you seen, you know, Frank Howarth?
Who?
Frank Howarth. He's a YouTube guy, but he does really, really nice work. He built his own table, and I think almost half of it drops on a hinge.
Oh.
And so he's done angled tenons and stuff on CNC, and he's done bowl manipulations by mounting them to a side and then dropping it at an angle.
Wow.
And routing into the side of a half-turned bowl and stuff. It's really, really kind of cool.
Oh, yeah. There's a whole new world out there that people are exploring, all kinds of crazy things. And it is fun. Part of the fun, too, is that you're out there in the unknown. And it's kind of fun being out in the unknown and trying to figure out how to do things. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what makes... For me, that's what makes woodworking fun is being there in the unknown and trying to figure things out.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of cool that new endeavor kind of came along and is becoming more and more available. And we're seeing a lot of people figure out new ways of doing a lot of things. It's really, really exciting.
Yeah. And the machines themselves keep getting cheaper and cheaper. And I think easier to use for us too. Which is fantastic. Now, one of the things, you mentioned being out there in the unknown and discovering new things. But one of the things that I think is really remarkable about you is you love to share your techniques. I mean, following you on Instagram is like a mini Green and Green tutorial sometimes about, okay, here's this one pool. Here's how I make it, you know. And you really go in and you've written a number of books on, you know, getting the details of Green and Green right and how you do those things. So that is fantastic that you know, you're out there sharing your knowledge with folks.
Yeah, well, it's fun, you know. That's how I learned, is people showed me how to do things, you know. So teaching and stuff like that has been kind of, at first it was really, I didn't like teaching because I didn't like getting up in front of people. Mm-hmm. Once I kind of got over that, then it was a lot of fun. You know, you not only meet a lot of really neat people when you teach, but it's fun when you're showing people how to do things and you see someone who really picks up on what's going on and they take it and go and make it their own. You know, I mean, they take what you showed them. And they take it beyond that. You know, that's exciting to me.
Right. Yeah. It is great. And one thing I have to ask you about is how did your little punches that Lee Valley sells, how did that come about? Because when I first started getting into Green and Green, I go, okay, I'm going to make a piece. And I'm going, well, I guess I'm going to have to get, you know, chisels from like a hollow chisel mortiser. And, you know, I started thinking about what sizes I needed. And about a week later, Lee Valley introduced these, and I was like, I've been saved.
Well, that came about, I had, someone had showed me the trick with the, taking a hollow chisel mortiser chisel and using it for, you know, taking it out of the machine and punching the holes. And the problem with that is I was doing all these 3/16 holes, and I couldn't find a 3/6. I found now that they do exist, but I didn't know where to find them then. 3/16 hollow chisel. So I had a machinist punch out kind of a real crude one, and I was using it. But I have a friend who would come to Seattle every once in a while, and he lived in upstate New York. He had he knew the people at Lee Valley.
Yeah.
You know, he knew them really well. He had had a relation. He had a warehouse that they rented when they first came to selling stuff in the U.S. And so he saw my little punch that I was using for the 3/16, and he says, "Why don't we turn this into Lee Valley?" You know, and so normally when you turn something into them for an idea, you've got to fill out a lot of forms and stuff like this. Well, we bypassed all that and went right to Robin Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And he just said, "Yeah, let's look into this." So they did it. It was fun. One of the fun things about it, though, is they turned it over to some real tool makers then. And, you know, and my little tool that I had made was really, really crude. And it was fun to see what they did. They made it a real tool. Mine was kind of a iffy thing.
Yeah. Well, that's great. That's great. And now you got those punches in a wide variety of sizes for yourself, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, so let's talk about what's next for you. You mentioned you're semi-retired and you're doing some spec pieces. So
yeah. Well, I love to woodwork.
Right.
What I do not love is pressure. You know, and I've kind of been working in the shop under pressure for way too many years, and it's time to remove the part that I don't like and do the part that I like.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm taking the pressure away, and then, you know, then, like I said earlier, I'm turning the shop into a place that's more friendly. You know, when I come in here in the morning, I want to look around and think, oh, this is a nice environment. I like being here because it just looks neat in here. You know,
right.
I still take on commissions, but only the ones that I want to. You know, and not I don't ever see myself doing a whole house full of furniture again. Those get really involved.
I can imagine. Yes,
they do. And they but, you know, I've had some employees that have worked for me over the years, and the stuff that I don't want, sometimes life is a little backwards, because, you know, when you're 25 years old, you've got just tons of energy. You know, you
right.
can just go, but no work coming in. When you're approaching 70, you don't have to advertise for work or anything. It's just there. But you don't have the energy now.
Yeah.
So I've got some guys that used to work for me, and they're taking on those big jobs that still come in. And I kind of selectively, I just took a job for a corner table, last week for myself.
Mm-hmm.
When I do those jobs myself, I tell them, you know, the due date is way out here somewhere. And I tell them that I'm semi-retired and I'm no hurry to get to this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want any pressure anymore.
Right.
But the other thing I want to do is just, pursue design. You know, that's my big passion is design. And I just want to explore things that have been on my mind for years, you know, and the other thing I want to do is, you know, over the last 20 years, I would design a piece, and first I would draw it up the way I really liked it. And then I'd look at it and I go, oh, you know, I can't produce it that way. I can't make money at it because it's just going to be too labor intensive and no one's going to pay for it. You know,
mm-hmm.
And so I trashed some of those designs and simplified them. Well, I'm going to revisit a few of those and do them the way I originally drew them now.
Oh, wow. That's going to be fantastic. Mm.
So then that'll be fun, you know, and kind of set the record straight. You know, sometimes some of these pieces I look at and I go, you know, it could have been like this, and it's not.
Right.
So I'm going to go back and do them.
Wow. Well, I can't wait for you to do that, because it's going to be interesting to see your take on your original take on some trusted designs.
Thanks.
That's going to be fantastic. Okay. Well, let's move on to our fortnightly beer choices. So, I have two recommendations. We recorded 2 days in a row.
All right.
But first up is last night I had the Carbach Rodeo Clown Double IPA. Hopefully that wasn't responsible for our recording snafu. But today I'd like to recommend Hill Country Fair Purified Spring Water.
There you go.
So what are you drinking, Sean?
Dehydrated. I'm sticking with the house usual, a tall can of Miller Lite. That's the everyday around here. It's basically water. So, right there.
There you go, Daryl. What are you drinking or recommend?
Well, I haven't had a beer since 1972. So, and I can't quite remember what it was back then. I used to drink a lot of beer. In fact, way too much beer. So that's kind of why I stopped.
Understood. Yeah. Well, Daryl, so where can folks find you on the internet?
Oh, furnituremaker.com.
Okay.
And then, if you just put my name into Instagram,
yes.
I can't remember if there's a dot in there or not.
Yeah,
just Daryl there Peart. Is. Okay, yeah. Daryl.Peart, I guess. Yeah, and that's where I'm most active at is Instagram. I've kind of backed off the last couple weeks. Or a month or so, and I need to get kind of back into it. I found out that you can get a kind of different kind of Instagram account where you can do long videos. And I think I'm going to do that, because those 1 minute videos are really tough to do sometimes.
Yeah, you can do the IGV videos.
That's what I want to do, I can just, I can go and I don't have to, I spend trying to, I get it down to 59 seconds and just right to the a hundredth of a second or something, you know, and I've cut out, sometimes I think I've just cut out way too much.
Right.
And
I think you have 15 minutes on the IG.
Yeah, that's much better.
I guess I've noticed those. I've never looked into how to creating them, because I don't really record videos.
Yeah, well, I've, you know, for my jigs.
Oh yeah, you have. Oh, absolutely.
Yes, I've done it a bunch. It's very similar to posting on Instagram. You just hit the plus button, and I think if you hit, and there's like an IGTV thing, you can also get a separate app. IGTV app and do it that way too, but you can do it within Instagram or within the IGTV app, at least on iPhone. I'm assuming that's across the board, it's pretty interesting. Let me see, there's a couple of apps out there. One's called, it's free, that's called Cut Story, that you can use if you have really long videos to break it up into, like if you have a 30 minute video, it'll automatically break it up into as many parts needed to post to IGTV. So you could have like a 15 minute video part one and like a 7 minute video part two, and break it up for you. But yeah, so highly recommend that. So Sean, where can folks find you?
You can find me at SeanW78 on Instagram and pretty much any other social media, including Untappd and Twitter and all those other things. How about you, Kyle?
Well, you can always find me at Barton.Kyle on Instagram, the only social media platform that matters. And with that, that just about wraps it up for this show. So if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on the podcatcher of your choice. Just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. Then you'll never miss any of our exciting episodes. And while you're there, leave us a review.
And thank you for listening. If you can, follow us on MWA underscore national on Twitter, on Instagram, we're MWA underscore podcast, or like us on Facebook. The best thing you can do is tell a friend, though. Word of mouth goes a long way in sharing our discussion.